Greetings, friends. This is Dr. Mark Sharona, and I want to welcome you to The Edge podcast, where all things theological, psychological, spiritual, and cultural will be explored so that you and I might understand the times and know what to do about them. Enjoy. I'm delighted today to have with us my dear friend, Dante Stewart, who is prolific in his writing. I think he's one of the emerging voices whose pen is mightier than a sword. He has just got an ability with words. His critical thinking skills are superb, and he's a voice. And I deeply appreciate his willingness to spend time with me, and I value what he has to say. And lately, he's been getting a lot of opportunity to be heard in a larger arena. And always, when you are in a larger arena, there's always going to be pushback, and there's always going to be opportunity for more conversation. And so I want to invite us as a listening audience to listen deeply and to hear a voice that I believe has something significant to share. And we're going to talk about some of the difficult issues and the hot button issues that if we avoid them, we're not going to get any further down the field. The arc of history, I believe the arc of history is intended to reveal how Christ progressively reveals his justice and righteousness in the earth. Now, we will never see the fullness of that until the second coming, but we certainly, as the people of God, are called to be fully identified with Christ's commitment to righteousness in the earth. And the word righteousness and justice, both in the Greek and in the Hebrew, are the same word. And being someone who is unashamedly a Pentecostal, these are issues that have been discussed from the very earliest days of the Azusa outpouring, precisely because of the dynamics that have surrounded what happened at Azusa, the issues with Charles Parham, how William Seymour had to overcome all those, and how the racial issue was a reality. And yet there were moments in that early Azusa outpouring where there really was a genuine oneness that was evidenced. William Seymour talked about it, but it didn't last. And so having all said all that, Dante, you are involved in so many conversations right now with so many voices, but give the people a little background about your own upbringing and then school and what it was like to be in a Reformed setting and all of that. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Bishop, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure. To get with you. It's like the Pentecostal convocation time. You know, we're in COVID right now. We can't have convocation. So we're going to have a little baby convocation today. But, you know, for me, I was raised in a Pentecostal home. I was very much Pentecostal and still to this day, very much Pentecostal.
You better be.
I'm super Pentecostal. in my upbringing, and you know, I was raised in rural South Carolina, and my mom is a baby of the 60s. My dad is a baby of the 50s, and both of them matriculated on the back end of the 60s, and really thrust into the movement for Black Power in the 70s. And what was so interesting about my upbringing, I was literally home yesterday, and my grandma, she ain't letting nobody come to the house. So I had to stand in the sunshine to talk to grandma, because she's talking about Corona. I get it. And so she wouldn't even let me come on the porch. So I had to talk to grandma in the sunshine. But my grandma, you know, she said something that really struck me, particularly about my upbringing. She was like, you know, I had W.E.B. Du Bois on my shirt, and, she was like, you know, your mama, she, Deborah, and that was my mom named Deborah. She said, Deborah would always have y'all going to those museums as kids. You know, y'all travel up north and go to the Smithsonian museums, and she get a little high pitched laugh. She said, you know, you ain't never forgot that. And I was like, yeah, grandma. At some point, you know, I did forget it, grandma, but I did come back in a sense. And so, you know, that's a part of my story, if I'm honest. That is a part of my story of being raised with a particular type of vision of Blackness and faith and Christianity as being profoundly integrated with one another, deeply steeped in this tradition of the Black freedom struggle for social, economic, political liberation, but also deeply steeped in a tradition of genuine solidarity rooted in one's belief in the resurrection and the Christian story as it is worked out in particular histories and the context. And so I was raised in that Pentecostal Black liberationist, Black power tradition of the intersection between faith and Christianity. But then, you know, I would go to Clemson and playing football at Clemson. And then I, you know, I forgot where I came from. You know, I was just thinking about this. You know, we always say, you know, don't forget where you come from. That was the thing, you know, back then is, you know, don't forget where you come from. But, you know, part of my story is in very fundamental ways, in very powerful ways, you know, I forgot where I came from. As I went to Clemson, my social surroundings and social networks and location began to change in very fundamental and powerful ways. So where I came from, that tradition, you know, of being Black and Pentecostal and radical and revolutionary, you know, I get to Clemson and playing football, and, you know, there's this kind of assimilation that I kind of went through into white culture or white Christianity. And even as a kid, there was this, you know, you knew it. Like as a kid, like our church was right by First Baptist, white church, First Baptist. And you knew, like, no, we don't go there. Like, that's not our people. That's not our church. That's not our space. Like there was no interaction there. And what's funny is that, you know, even I was there yesterday driving back in through my hometown, and there's now where we would take the back road to church, which would pass behind First Baptist. They now cut off that road and like built a barrier. And it may not be something, but symbolically speaking, that was always our road that we took to church. And now there's a barrier between our road that we took because it's on their property. And so going to college, there was always, you know, a part of me that I didn't forget where I come from, but I really did forget where I came from, where, you know, as I was at Clemson, you know, now I'm inside of FCA, and, you know, you're hearing names like, yeah, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and in those college ministries, you're not connected to Black church ministries, you know, Black ministries there. They're just not there. It's like a given that white evangelical ministries kind of, that is their territory, that is their space. And so now I was introduced with John Piper and these names like Matt Chandler and Francis Chan and all these guys in a new kind of young restless reform group.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and so now I'm getting this kind of language of, you know, this type of Christianity that was foreign to me, but because, you know, because I was kind of so deeply inundated into that space, I started to associate this type of education, quote unquote, and language and type of doing Christianity of rock bands and lights and, you know, books on theology and things like this as being the Christian faith. And oftentimes so many young people and so many people in general go through that, to where when they get engaged with white evangelicalism, it becomes, this is right and this is true Christianity. And that's not simply racial, but it's also denominational, that, you know, Pentecostals, they catch it real hard in that space. There's no love per se for Pentecostals in that space. And so then I would kind of now deeply immersed in that space and went off to California, got engaged in Calvary Chapel, start preaching, teaching, leading. Then, you know, even more got engaged with street preaching. And now and I'm deeply involved. Now looking back in hindsight, I'm deeply involved in these kind of movements now that, as I look in hindsight today, are like these movements today that's like, you know, critical race theory, you know, Black liberation theology of racism, and, you know, the Black church is not solid and healthy, and James White and John MacArthur Crowes and people like that. And so I got deeply immersed in that. And one of the saddest parts of my story that, you know, I guess it's very important to tell this, because I'm sure other people went through this, is that when, you know, Michael Brown happened in 2014, when Ferguson happened, I was that black dude that didn't feel it. I didn't feel Ferguson. When Barack Obama preached that preached a eulogy for Charleston 9, for Clementa Pinckney, I was the black person that was like, you know, how could, you know, Barack Obama preach the gospel and he's not a Christian? And so I was deeply immersed in this space. You know, people would like to say, you know, yeah, that's, you know, that's you made the decision to do that. That's just not the case. Yes, I made a decision, but oftentimes our decisions and our choices are rooted in a particular social environments that we find ourselves in.
Absolutely.
You know, the social environment of this type of reformed Christianity, evangelicalism, was deeply rooted in a certain type of Christianity that was deeply anti-black, that was deeply arrogant and just mean. And I really took on that type of spirit. And then I got introduced deeply to the reform type of space when I got to Georgia, when we got stationed over here, preaching, teaching, leading once again in that space. And then things started to change where, you know, we're over here and now I'm back working in enterprise and I'm around black people again because my social networks was in white evangelicalism and white evangelical church. And I'm back around black people at enterprise and preaching, teaching in this Reformed Baptist church. Then shootings happened, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, then Donald Trump happened. And Bishop, it was almost as if like I was getting hit by event after event that was kind of waking me up out of my kind of horrible thinking, really waking me up about, you know, how wrong I was on the issue of race, on the issue of Christianity, on, you know, just how powerful the voices I was listening to had become in my life. And my mama, you know, it was funny. My mama was, when I kind of changed, mama was like, I was wondering, you know, when you was going to get out of them white people church. because it's something, you know, black people in her generation know how deeply limiting that space is. And I'll never forget one day I was talking about race with my coworkers and, you know, all these shootings happened and Trump happened. I'm around white brothers and sisters that's, you know, I'm starting to get angry and confused about this space and starting to say stuff. And people, you know, are saying, you know, just preach the gospel. You know, I don't have journeys on race. And, you know, what about black on black crime? Or we gave you a black president. And I'm like, it just didn't feel good. It just felt like horrible. Like to the point, like I was liable to fight somebody. I went to church angry. I was liable to fight somebody because I knew that what they were saying was deeply offensive, deeply racist. And then Michaela happened, my coworker. I'm at work and we're talking about race. And I won't say the actual term, but I was saying like, you know, until Black Lives Matter, it won't matter to anybody else. And I was talking all this rhetoric and Michaela was like, you know, Stu, you don't have a darn thing, insert other word, curse word, to offer black people. And then I went home. I'm angry. I'm hurt. And I went home and I talked to my wife and I was griping to her. And then my wife was like, yo, you always listen to everybody else before you listen to me. And man, Bishop, my wife had been telling me for at least 3 years, of how horrible my thoughts were on race and how offensive they were to her as my wife being black, how hurtful, how destructive, how harmful. And then Michaela, and then the conversations that I was having. And man, I went to church. My confusion really turned to rage then. Like I was deeply hurt, but then it turned to rage because I knew, like I had to ask myself the question, not simply why am I here in this space, but what has this space made me? What has it done to me? Like, who am I? And that was the most disturbing question.
Right.
Was what have I become in this space? And my brother Drew Hall, you know, gave me a book. He was like, Stu, yo, white brother too. Trueheart was like, yo, Stu, I need you. I think you're going to really enjoy this book. You need to read this book. And Bishop, the book was Where Do We Go From Here by Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King.
True handed me that book, and I devoured that book. And it was that section where he quoted James Baldwin, a letter to my nephew. And Baldwin was quoting to his nephew in that letter that's in the Fire Next Time, where he says, you know, these men are your brother. And if love is to mean anything, he says, if it is to mean anything, it's that we with love shall force our brothers to deal with reality as it is and to change it. And I accessed that letter and read the whole thing. And he says, it was intended that you should perish, but you did not. He says, do not be afraid. Great men have done great things in this country, and they will again. Don't be driven from your country. And it was as if, for me, it was as if, you know, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off. And, you know, after that, I devoured everything by Black people that I could. I said, you know, Lord, I really want to learn, what does it mean to be Black? What does it mean to be Christian? What does it mean to speak in this moment? And I did, and I never looked back. And for me, it probably has been one of the most empowering, encouraging, and liberating experiences ever to re-enter my tradition, reassess my roots, and be reconnected to my people in such a way that it was almost as if, you know, that Pentecostal baptized in the Holy Ghost and filled them and being filled with tongues, being filled with the Holy Ghost, with the evidence of speaking in tongues, and that ecstatic feeling of the Spirit, the Holy Ghost coming on the people. For me, that's what I felt, is that, you know, there was that spirit of in Numbers 11, with the spirit where it says the Spirit went on the people, yeah, and they shouted and they spoke like prophets. And man, when the Spirit, you know, of Jesus, evidence, you know, in the spirit of liberating Blackness came on me, you know, I, in some sense, you know, spoke like a prophet. And I knew that that was my journey that I needed to do. And it hasn't been easy. You know, I've lost a lot of friendships, a lot of opportunities.
I'm sure. But, so let me go back. You're making me think about a whole lot of things that I want to ask you about. Let me comment first, if I can. So our journey to wholeness, our journey to what Carl Jung would call individuation, what we in theology would call the integration of our heart and our mind, the reintegration of the head and the heart. The prodigal son has to come to himself in order to go back to his father. Peter is in prison, and it says he has this encounter. He has to come to himself. So if we isolate this come to himself, all of us have to have this journey where we come to ourselves. So you were on that journey. You come to this moment, and you get reintroduced or initially introduced, like, because I know you mentioned William Dubois. Now, when I was in Raleigh, pioneering the church in Raleigh, where we did our first pioneering was in Raleigh, and we've talked about the fact that we built, mm-hmm, intentionally built for the sake of cross-cultural ministry, and so we had our share of. I saw what white privilege was firsthand when I left New York and Pittsburgh and went down to Raleigh, North Carolina. And you know that we have a Black son. So, these are realities. White privilege is not something that I don't get upset when I hear the term, because I have lived it both as a pastor in Raleigh, and I've lived it vicariously through the pain of my son and what we've had to go through with his issues. But I remember back in those days, I read voraciously. I still do, but I read William Dubois. Cornel West's voice was emerging. I was reading Cornel West. I was reading James Cone, and others. Willie Jennings was a member of my church, and he was on staff at Duke. He had to put up with my. I can't believe I go back and say to myself, you know, Sharona, you God was very gracious that Willie just sat there and smiled while you preached, and could have probably preached you under the barn, under the pulpit, and talked circles around your theology. Willie endured me all those years. God bless him, he did. But the voices that you began to read, because I think those are important voices to understand the journey and also to help the Caucasian community understand that there are readings of scripture that we cannot discount.
Yes. And to that point, you know, that I think for me, that was the most powerful thing for me is to, you know, it was the type of Pentecost is that, you know, we were able to declare the works of the Lord through our own tongue.
Right.
Exactly. And that tongue had legitimacy. Absolutely. And so for us, for me, hearing the works of God in my own tongue was incredibly formative.
Affirming.
Absolutely. Affirming, yes, and empowering. It was almost as if, like, you know, I could only imagine, you know, what, like, we don't know this, but I don't know if this is the case. This is kind of my sanctified imagination. Like, I wondered if the disciples on the road to Emmaus were at Pentecost. And what was it like for them to experience the lonely road of Pentecost, where the movement that you are a part of has been not only disrespected, but in some sense for them, their movement has been destroyed. That lonely walk of Emmaus represents for them a type of death, a type of ending. In some sense, but when Jesus comes alongside them and tell them to return back to Jerusalem, the end for their lives represents another type of beginning, a type of, you know, in some sense, they were the living type of metaphor for Ezekiel's, can these bones live? Mm-hmm. And I just wonder what were they at Pentecost when the Spirit came down and they were able to experience what it meant to for their stories, their narratives, that at one point was characterized by loneliness and a type of longing, but now it's characterized by liberation and love and being able to be included into a certain type of story that was counter to the story that they had experienced. It should not surprise us that Jesus in the Gospels tell the people who are marginalized and oppressed to come to me and learn from me, to learn for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. They had learned the bad religion of the day. They learned the lessons of imperialism and dominance. And Jesus invites them to learn with him, which in some sense, for me, means to learn what it means for your story to intersect with the story of God and to allow your voice to be able to be vocal and legitimate in shaping your world and you not lose any part of yourself, but your type of reality becomes ever expansive, ever dynamic, ever inclusive as you seek to embody what we theologically say to be the reign of God. But if we talk about politically speaking and democracy, it means in some sense that your voice matter for this multiracial work of democracy. And so for me, hearing those voices on theologically speaking and hearing those voices in the social world, in the political world, were incredibly transformative and formative for me. And I believe in some sense, you know, because theology, you know, as Daniel, I think his name is Miglior, I think Daniel Miglior, theologian, I think out of Princeton, in Faith, Think, and Understanding, he says, you know, that theology, in some sense, is it, you know, that theology, in some sense, is integrated in the voices of the people, that Dietrich Bonhoeffer would say that theology must grow from below. And so for us, as we say, you know, our theology is legitimate and that we need that type of work, you know, we believe that God, you know, is a God who cares about all people. And so therefore, all people must be able to have voice to declare the wonderful works of God. And if in some sense, as Revelation teaches us that the voices of the people are heard and heard in glory, telling of the works of God. And if they are in glory, then that lets us know that they testified in the present and in the past. And so if they testified in the past, then they're always testifying in our present. And so if they're going to testify in our present, then they must be able to testify to a future that they are in. And so Black people, Black liberation theology, and preaching our our theology that grows out of our experience of God in the black and black life in America as legitimate is that good news, that euangelion that is bound to the black voice in America. And I think, you know, it's not only transformative for, you know, resurrecting a certain type of dignity that has been stolen from us, but it also, in some sense, resurrection on the other side of resurrection is always witness.
Yeah. So
we witness.
You bear witness. So here's a profound thought that I'd like you to expound. Obviously, because I share your convictions, and I understand the term liberation theology. Now let's talk about the reform world you came out of. If you use the words liberation theology, are already a heretic. Now, help me with this. So I have read James Cone. And the way I look at, and James was a brilliant, brilliant voice, a prophetic voice, shaped much of my consciousness in terms of my pastoral care from the time we were in Raleigh until now. In many ways, I mean, just his book on the blues and jazz.
Oh yeah, powerful book.
Coming out of the songs of sorrow. We would call them spirituals. He called them songs of sorrow. Or Dubois called them the songs of sorrow. And he picked up on that. But for a black liberation theology, it's different than some of the other liberation theologies. There are some liberation theologies, the goal is to get Christ off the cross. That is not the case with black liberation theology. It is not to get Christ off the cross. It moves further than that towards the resurrection. Talk a little bit about why we need to hear the term liberation theology within a faithful context of scripture. And a hermeneutic that understands the community.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I could tell so many different stories, you know, from the Bible, you know, of this kind of liberationist hermeneutic, of this kind of liberationist imagination in the scriptures. Of course, the first one for us, in some sense, for many people, especially for black people, is the Exodus narrative.
The Exodus
narrative of, you know, Moses being God's spokesperson of embodying God's solidarity with the oppressed and God's burning away of oppression, where the fire went out at the burning bush because the fire must burn both in Moses and in Egypt. Now that's my sanctified imagination.
All right.
The fire went out, it must burn in Moses and burn in Egypt. And so the fire, in some sense, it's like James Baldwin. It was the fire next time. So it was at the bush and now it's in Egypt. But, you know, beyond that, because many of my white brothers and sisters love the Gospels, and I get it. I mean, that Paul is like, you know, Paul is, he's Pastor Paul. I mean, Paul, you know, because in history, you know, there's an excellent book, The Genesis of Liberation, by Emma Sipari and Rodney Sadler, which goes into this kind of understanding of how black people in history have understood how to read the Bible, our kind of hermeneutical lens that becomes our lived homiletic through our life, our preach experience. And so they decipher that oftentimes, you know, our history of how we read the Bible in America, it grew out of, you know, this settler colonialist lens, which is, you know, this lens of domination and control, God sanctioning a certain type of manifest destiny, whereby which Europeans become the master teacher. And it's back to Dr. Jennings and his work, The Christian Imagination. He's done excellent work working out this history. Absolutely. But for us, you know, in the Gospels, when we look at Jesus, liberation theology, what's interesting about it is that for us, you know, for our tradition, we don't need in some sense, you know, Marxist thought to become, you know, who we will become, who we are. you know, because many people, when they hear the term liberation theology, it becomes the boogeyman, and the straw man becomes, you know, hey, you're critical race theorist and you're a Marxist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us, we didn't need, you know, Marx. Marx was years down the road, and Marxist analysis was years down the road from Black theology as it worked out in slave quarters and hush harbors, and kind of grew out of that, moving through the Underground Railroad and beyond, and in the AME church and in the early Black Christian traditions. But the way we read Jesus was built on two things. Well, really three things. I would say three things, kind of leaning on James Evans' incredible book, We Have Been Believers, that we read the story of Jesus as a story of solidarity, a story of healing, and a story of liberation. Or to use a womanist lens, a womanist theology is Black women's theology, that they read the story of Jesus as a story of freedom, of exorcism, and a story of healing. And so, you know, this story of Jesus to say, you know, that Jesus understood what it meant to live in solidarity with those who were left out of society. Jesus in his ministry embodied a certain type of healing ministry that wanted to fix that which was broken, not simply in the individual's experience, but in their political configuration and in the social world. But also Jesus wanted to liberate people from systems and experiences of domination, dehumanization, and exploitation. And to use a womanist hermeneutic, that Jesus exorcised the demons that are embodied in the systems of society, and that Jesus heals the wounds and the bodies that are being forgotten and broken. And how do we see this work out? We see this work out literally, to go to the Bible, literally worked out in Mark chapter 5. That when we go to Mark chapter 5, we see that there is a man in Mark chapter 5 who is bound up in his community, and he is locked up in chains. He's dealing with the demonic oppression of what it means to be under the control and the dominance of a force outside of himself. He is a person. He is a human, but he has forces working outside of himself that are seeking to destroy not simply his mind, but seeking to destroy his life. And he's not only dealing with oppression and dominance, but he's dealing with dehumanization and marginalization from his community. So the community is playing a part in this as well. And so to use kind of language of intersectionality, we have to look at, you know, the intersectional lens.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. Yes, he's an individual, but there are experiences of marginalization and oppression that intersects with other realities, that he's a person, but he's also marginalized. He's dealing with physical struggles, but he also dealing with psychological struggles. He's not only dealing with, what does it mean to be a person within the society, but he also dealing with what does it mean to be marginalized within a particular community. So Jesus comes to town and he talks to the demon. The demon says, "We are legion." The people would have known during that time that legion represent a certain type of, it's a Roman connotation, it's a Roman term. They would have understood that legion was this kind of Roman kind of name. And so as some scholars would say that this kind of Roman reality was that in some sense his psychological struggle was that this dominance of Rome, this demonic oppression of imperialism has now taken over his mind. And now he's bound to the struggle of psychological abuse and demonic abuse and oppression. So Jesus comes as this man, they say legion. Now Jesus says, okay, go into the pigs. Jesus cast the demon out of the man. He casts the demon into the pigs. The pigs get cast into the sea. And this is where the Black liberationist hermeneutic comes in a powerful, powerful way. It is not, in some sense, the way how we read scripture. It's one of the various ways that Christian traditions have done theology. And as Absolutely. We know, and if
all,
we do-
All the way back to origin. All the way back to
literally.
The
literally, as we do, as we think about Christian traditions and theology, we have various traditions who have emphasized certain type of ways of reading scriptures that have been life-giving for how one lives out faith, hope, love as an embodied Absolutely. Practice.
And the, so ancient, the, liberal, the ancient Jews did the same long before
exactly.
Christianity. The scholars in exile, as they sought to piece together, why are we here and we want to get back home, they put together all the ancient writings and they exactly. begin to look at the story of Abraham and say, how does exactly. that apply to us now? How does Moses apply to us now? Exactly. That's exactly right.
Exactly. And so the way that the Black liberationist lens and womanist lens reads the story of the man in Mark chapter 5 is that when Jesus liberates and heals this man, he does not simply heal this man and liberates him. The story says that the demons are cast out into the pigs and then the pigs into the sea. And the man is now clothed and in his right mind. Right. So if he's clothed and in his right mind, he's now unlocked from the chains that had him bound. And now his mind is now liberated from the psychological abuse, but also there is a certain type of physical freedom that has now taken place. But there is another interesting part of the story. If we understand Jewish history, we would understand that inside of the Jewish narrative, as we see in Peter, they don't eat swine, they don't eat pigs. So the relevant question of this story is, why are pigs in proximity with a people who knew that there would be problematic when they go into public life, in religious life and communal life? Why were pigs inside of proximity to a certain type of people who knew them to be problematic? Well, as one scholar would tell us, I think Harvey Cox would say that, and I found this to be incredibly good, incredibly, incredibly good, that Harvey Cox said that the reason why pigs were there was because the Romans, when they would come to town, they would need to have meat there for them, and they would use pigs as a way, in some sense, to exploit the people. And so the people have pigs here, and they know what pigs mean in proximity with them, that they could not literally be who they were. They can't engage in the physical, communal, political, social life of temple life because they would be ceremonially and socially unclean. And so when Jesus takes the demon and goes into the pigs and the pigs cast themselves into the sea, Jesus is not simply saying that I came here to make this man's soul right. Jesus is saying that I came to liberate him from psychological abuse and oppression, but I also not simply came to liberate the individual, but I came to liberate the community from political oppression that are bound to problematic pigs. And so when we look at the pigs being cast into the sea, Jesus is in effect saying that I'm not simply liberating you, but I'm sending a message that I came to liberate communities. And isn't it interesting that the community responds in fear because they know what it means when these Romans show up and pigs are here? That is a statement of resistance and revolution. That is a statement that we are now not going to accept what you have put upon us. And so Black people, we come to that passage and we get life from that passage because in some sense, we realize that we are that man. We are that community. We read into that story that Jesus wants to not simply liberate us, but liberate us as individuals, but to liberate us into a certain type of wholeness. And so we read that to say that the hermeneutic of liberation is not simply, you know, a good hermeneutic, but is a life-giving hermeneutic where one lives their faith, especially in America, that has not only, you know, showed them to be second class. Because as we think about this understanding of racial capitalism and Charles Mills and many of the Black theorists of racial capitalism, we see this experience of racial capitalism in some sense in that narrative that the people are second-class citizens, their labor and their work are exploited, and they are continually disrespected. They are second-class, they are exploited, and simply having pigs there is disrespecting the people. And so when Jesus liberates and brings the community to healing the wholeness, he restores dignity, he restores power, he restores wholeness, he restores agency, and that experience of bones living has become a reality.
Profound. That is profound. You know what you reminded me just now? back in 1970, Tom Skinner preached at Urbana, Illinois, at the InterVarsity Conference, and unpacked the systemic realities. And he got a standing ovation. I mean, you can watch the message on YouTube. But here he was, let's fast forward to the 80s, where it's Atlanta, major pastors conference. This is 15, 16 years later, maybe 17 years later, might have been 1987. Atlanta, thousands of pastors from America and around the world. He gets up and preaches from Revelation, every tribe, every kindred, every tongue. And the title of the message is "Don't Leave Me Out of the Choir."
Mm.
And 15 years later, and he's still talking the same stuff, but he begins with, as best as I can recall, that he invites, because most of the audience was Caucasian, and he knew he wanted to say something that they needed to hear. And he begins with, "I want you to understand," and I'm paraphrasing, "life at the bottom of the garbage heap looks a lot different when you're there than if you're the one throwing out the garbage."
Wow.
And
that's so good.
That established the parameters from which he then began to talk about the construct of race, the construct of how systemically it has affected us. Tom was brilliant. You might be too young to remember Tom Skinner.
No, I actually listened to the Urbana sermon. Yeah, okay. Multiple times, actually.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one. It's a really good one.
Yeah, Tom was a voice in our generation. But you're reminding me of all these issues, and we still have a long way to go. And So we've come to the end of this podcast. But Dante, first of all, I want to thank you for your transparency. Thank you for your years of labor and study. You're certainly an emerging voice. I for one, am listening. I'm delighted to listen. I'm learning, and I'm deeply grateful for the hand of God on your life. I value the deposit in you, and my prayer for you is that God would enlarge your coast and your territory, and like Jabez, that it would not pain you. That it may not pain me. That would be my heart's desire for you. But we certainly want to make our viewing audience, listening audience, know that you have materials that they can access. I mean, you've written a number of articles. You've got a liturgical lectionary, a devotional that I use this year for Lent. I mean, you are prolific. But just talk a little bit about how people can get to know more about Dante and how they can follow you.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. On social media, I'm at Stuart Dante C, StewartDante, C as in Christian, which is actually my middle name, Christian. And so you can follow me that way. My writings, most of my writings lately have been, on Sojourners, Christianity Today. Just wrote my recent first piece for the Washington Post. So that was cool. It was featured on CNN. So you could just go on my social media. You can get my stuff. I'm also in the process of writing my first book that working really hard on and reading and thinking and studying. It's entitled "The Caged Bird Still Sings: Being Black in an Anti-Black World," where I'm trying to, in some sense, give a message in this moment of what it means to be both Black and Christian and millennial, speaking of faith and race and politics and the church and everything. It's gonna be good. But just keep up. Keep up. And I always hit people back, and I love connecting with people or whatnot. We in some dark days, and I think each one of us, have a part to play that the Lord want us to do.
Dante, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I love you, bro.
I love you too, man.